I always like to start with this particular slide. This shows each of the objects in our solar system to the same size, to the same scale. So you can see that we're dwarfed by the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, which will be the main topic of these talks. But the reason I put this slide up is because of all the other stuff that's there. If you just focus your eyes for a second on these objects in the bottom right-hand corner, these are all objects that we know as Kuiper Belt objects. Some of you will be familiar with the fact that Pluto, poor Pluto, back in 2006, was demoted in its planetary status from a fully-fledged planet to what we now call a Plutino, or a dwarf planet. And there's some very good reasons for that. And the main reason is the fact that there are literally thousands of objects out there beyond the orbit of Neptune, which could also class as something very similar to Pluto. So instead of requiring school children to go ahead and learn thousands of planetary names in our solar system, we've chosen to just restrict it to 8, plus a large collection of dwarf planets. And you can see, we don't know very much about these places. They're so dim and so distant that we're not able to measure very large amounts of photons from these planets to figure out what their chemistry, composition and surface properties are like. This is really terra incognita out here in the distant solar system. For each of the giants, those of you with keen eyesight will also be able to see that they're host to a diverse satellite system. And those satellites, each of them, if they didn't orbit around a giant planet, would be a fascinating destination in their own right for us to one day go and explore with planetary robotic spacecraft, or one day potentially with human beings going to these far-flung distant targets. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those satellites in a few minutes. But the reason I put this slide up is to try and give you a sense of what is the main question that we as planetary scientists are trying to address. Why are they all so different? What physical processes or chemical processes back 4.5 billion years ago, when all of these planets were first forming, has led to this huge diversity of atmospheric structures, of planetary surfaces? Why are they not all alike? And what are the processes which has driven that divergence of these different planetary types? Now, that question has become really important over the past several years with the discovery of literally hundreds of planets around other stars. This all started back in 1995. Now, people think that we've known about planets around other stars for many, many decades. Star Trek, Captain Kirk was always going to a new planet in every single episode, but it wasn't until 1995 that we discovered our first extrasolar planet. Since then, NASA and the European Space Agency has had several missions up there trying to spot these planets by them occulting their host stars. So these tiny planets will move in front of their parent stars and cause the light from the star to dim in a fraction of a percent. But that fraction of a percent dimming is enough for us to detect one of these extrasolar planets. These are all of the planets we've discovered so far to scale. And in fact, this cartoon is actually a little bit old now. We've discovered almost 863 planets we now know of out there in our galaxy. Now, for those planets, our collection of 8 should be known as the perfect template for interpreting what the conditions might be like on these planets around other stars. Now, these planets are rather alien compared to them, the planets that we have. For example, they're so hot that instead of clouds of water vapour or clouds of ammonia that we might find in our solar system, there are clouds of iron and clouds of silicate material. There's even vaporised ceramics forming cloud layers in some of these extremely hot extrasolar planets. So maybe my idea of using our planets as a template isn't quite correct, but certainly the same physical processes are leading to the generation of those rather unusual cloud systems. Now, my specialty is with the giant planets of our solar system. And what we've done here is we've taken all of the giant planet systems and shrunk them down so the planets are the same scale. You can see that each of the planets has a form of ring system, varying from the very large, dense and thick rings of something like Saturn to the very diffuse, dusty rings of something like Jupiter. They all have an extensive satellite system, and those satellites, just like planets in our solar system, varying as you move further and further away from the Sun, the satellites in a system such as Jupiter vary as you move away from the central planet Jupiter. So Io versus Europa versus Ganymede versus Callisto are all different, and that tells you a story about how these satellites first formed. So these planets, for a meteorologist like myself, I'm interested in their atmospheres, which ties in really nicely to the exhibition that's going on here at the museum at the moment. Without any pesky mountain ranges in the way, no continents, no valleys, no oceans to disturb the flow, you can think of these giant balls of gas as perfect atmospheres. The winds, the dynamics, the chemistry that you see at work on these giant planets is in its pure, unadulterated form, which is why someone like myself is so interested in studying them. But my reasons are slightly closer to home as well. Our generation is fortunate to be observing and seeing the surfaces of some of these locations in our solar system for the very first time. There won't be another generation like this that gets to see things for the first time. I can't make that point strongly enough. This image, all of these images, are from the vantage point of a human being standing on the surface and looking out across the terrain. You'll be probably familiar with the image from the lunar surface taken by the Apollo astronauts now over 40 years ago when the last man stepped foot on the moon. The other images, with the exception of the Earth's ocean, were all taken by robotic spacecraft. And here in Oxford, we have a hand in designing, building and operating these robotic spacecraft at these far-flung locations. This one I'm particularly excited about. Titan is the largest moon of Saturn, and it's a really unusual place in that it's a satellite with a thick, smoggy atmosphere. That atmosphere has got a lot of nitrogen and a lot of carbon dioxide. The only thing it lacks, which would allow us to compare it to somewhere like planet Earth, is any oxygen. Okay, so it's a lot of nitrogen and a lot of carbon dioxide. Some say it may be a prebiotic Earth. That might be what Earth looked like in the distant days. The pebbles you see on the surface of Titan are pebbles of ice, of water ice. They've been eroded over the course of time by the flow of liquid across the surface. Where this probe landed back in 2005 was in a riverbed. And it's not a river of liquid water, it's a river of liquid methane flowing across the surface of this rather odd place. But we can understand all of the processes which formed that particular image in terms of processes that we know and love here on planet Earth. I think if you were to sum up what planetary exploration has given us over the last 40 years, it's shown us that some of these environments aren't quite as alien as we once thought. Yes, the colours are different and the chemistry, the mix of different gases is slightly altered compared to the Earth, but we can use what we know if we were to stand in Arizona or if we were to stand in a lake bed somewhere else around the planet or a dry region in Antarctica. We can use our physics and chemistry to understand what we see on the surfaces of these strange worlds. For the giant planets, however, studying them is extremely complicated. Just to get to a giant planet takes upwards of about $1 billion to fly there, which is a huge amount of money to invest. Because of that, and because of the length of time it takes to get there, around about 8 years for a mission to get to Jupiter and Saturn, you might only get to see one of these during the course of an academic career. I'm very lucky in that I started my career when the Cassini spacecraft was arriving at Saturn. Now, each of the lines on this figure represents a single mission that humankind has flown to the outer solar system. So you see one orbiter around the planet Saturn. There were a couple of flyby missions as well back in the 70s and 80s. But this particular orbiter is telling us fascinating things about this planet that we didn't know before. Take a look at Uranus and Neptune, though. Those have had a single interplanetary visitor over the entire course of human exploration of our solar system. Voyager 2 flew past in 1986 and 1989. We have not been back since, and we have no plans to go back, at least for the next couple of decades. By the time we return to those worlds, using updated technology that we're developing now, 50 years will have elapsed since our last look. So doing a planetary science degree, you have to be in it for the long game, trust me. You can't plan 2 years ahead or 3 years ahead, you have to plan 20 years ahead. And I think over the course of the next few slides, I'll try and show you some of the exciting developments that are coming up over the next few years. Now, planetary weather is a catch-all term that I like to use. I'm dividing things up into the broad climate of these giant planets. If you look at something like Jupiter, the first thing that strikes you are the candy stripes, the beautiful coloured east and west bands that you see in the atmosphere of Jupiter. Now, those are basically a product of the rapid rotation of Jupiter. It goes round once every 10 hours or so. So the length of a single day on Jupiter is 10 hours long. The natural state for an atmosphere in that sort of environment is to form these banded structures. And in fact, all of the giant planets, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, they all show a similar banding, albeit with slightly less contrast as Jupiter, which is probably the best studied and the best known. We also have features that are long-lived over the course of time, things like Jupiter's Great Red Spot that you may all have heard of. This is a gigantic swirling hurricane, a red feature in the atmosphere of Jupiter. We know to have been present for at least 130 years, possibly even as long ago as observations by Robert Hooke, for example, back 400 years ago, although we're not certain that the same spot that Hooke saw is actually the spot that we've been observing over the past century or so. We have features that evolve extremely quickly. Often in the news you'll see things like enormous plumes or storms erupting in the atmospheres of these giant planets, which evolve over the course of a few hours. They create structures that maybe we will be able to observe for weeks or possibly months. And I'll tell you about one on Saturn that has actually been present for a couple of years now. And in addition to that, these giant planets are taking so long to orbit around the Sun, 10 years for somewhere like Jupiter, and 160 odd years for something like Neptune, that we're trying to observe how the seasons change on these giant planets. But a season on a giant planet like Saturn might be 8 Earth years long. You need a data set that goes over 8 Earth years to be able to sample just a single season. Again, these are all challenges that we face. So here in Oxford, we use a technique called remote sensing. And if you look around the exhibition, you'll see remote sensing apparatus used for our own planet Earth, but also for planets like Venus, like Mars, and the giant planets. We take images and spectra at a huge variety of wavelengths, from the ultraviolet through the visible, the infrared, and even out as far as the microwave and the radio. And we try to interpret what we see at all those different wavelengths using computer models. What these computer models do is you set up a first approximation for what you think that atmosphere is like, you synthesize what the image or the spectrum should look like, and you compare it to the data. If your comparison shows that you were dead wrong in the first place, you go back and you tweak your model, and you do this iteratively, constantly updating and manipulating your model until it reproduces the observations that you see. Once you have reproduced those observations, you have a model atmosphere, which is a good, statistically plausible atmosphere that could explain what we're seeing in the data. And from that, we can investigate a range of topics, from the meteorology that I'll be telling you about today. We can study the chemistry of the giant planets as well. We can look at cloud formation. And this is a rather interesting one, the origins and formation. When the giant planets formed, our best understanding of what happened was that a core of rocky material, maybe 10 Earth masses in size, formed first. We called these the protoplanets, and this was all happening about 4.5 billion years ago. It was a time when planets were frequently colliding with each other, dissipating and then re-agglomerating into another rocky sphere. At a certain point, that rocky sphere had such a large mass that it accreted all of the gas that was left over in the nebula. It sucked it in gravitationally to create these enormous balls of gas of hydrogen and helium and various other species that you see today. So, in a way, the giant planets contain within their chemical makeup signatures of what the gases and the rocks were like back 4.5 billion years ago. You can almost think of them as providing a window onto the distant past and telling us what the solar system was like in those early days. So that's an active region of study for groups like ours in Oxford. On to Cassini at Saturn and some of the latest the results that we're getting. Now, if you've not heard of the Cassini spacecraft before, I urge you to go online, place it into Google, and you'll see the wealth of scientific discoveries that Cassini has been making over the past several years now. It launched back in 97, took 7 years to fly all the way out in the frigid depths of space to Saturn, over a billion kilometres away, arrived in 2004 for a projected 4-year mission. We got to the end of 2008, and this spacecraft is still working perfectly, flawlessly. All the instruments are still, all the nuts and bolts are still greased, and everything's still going tickety-boo. So, we carry on for another 2 years extension, and a continuous extension. And now, we're hoping to get all the way through what we call the Solstice mission to 2017. 2004 to 2017 is a time period sufficiently long that we'll have seen winter, spring, summer and autumn on Saturn and its various satellites and rings. So we'll have seen through half of a Saturnian year the seasons affecting all the dynamics and chemistry and clouds as they possibly can in that particular atmosphere. Cassini is about the size of a small bus. The high-gain antenna just there is 3.5 metres across. I think I've got a statistic somewhere that it's got over 14 kilometres of electrical cabling on board. And the reason that Oxford is assisting in analysing the data from this particular mission is that we helped to build the SEERS instrument, which is just here on the left. And you can see part of the engineering or the flight spare in the exhibition over the back there. This SEERS instrument measures thermal energy. It measures the emission of heat from all of the various surfaces in that system, whether it be the atmosphere, the surfaces of a moon like Titan, or the rings themselves. They all emit heat in various different ways. And that's the kind of thing I'll be talking about later on. Now, no talk about Cassini would be complete without talking a little bit more about Titan. In 2005, the Huygens probe, which was built by the European Space Agency, detached from the side of the Cassini spacecraft and plummeted through the thick, smoggy atmosphere of Titan. Now, Titan's atmosphere is so opaque to visible light that all you see is an orange, hazy, fuzzy, gunky appearance when you look at visible wavelengths. We'd never seen the surface of Titan. And so it was anybody's guess as to what the surface might be like. There were theories about it being moist soil on the surface, or covered in a kind of sludgy hydrocarbon gunk, or possibly even lakes of seas of things like methane and liquid ethane. So as the probe descended, these are various images taken from underneath the parachute, the probe looking out with its cameras across the terrain. And what you can see are mountain ranges, river valleys. In fact, if I go to the next slide, yeah. This image just here, if you've got very keen eyesight, you can see all the dendritic channels of rivers flowing into a single channel and then out into an outflow basin on the surface of Titan just there. We landed in that outflow basin. And by measuring the porosity and the mechanical properties of the soil underneath the probe as it landed, we suggest that we landed in a dried up lake bed, but soon after methane rain had fallen on the surface of Titan. Now just get that into your heads for a second. Methane raindrops falling on an alien world through a smoggy, orange, hazy atmosphere. In fact, the physics of forming these methane droplets means that they form extremely large raindrops, not the tiny few millimetre size when you're thinking about water falling on our own planet. These are huge droplets that form these dendritic channels and then the outflow channels. Titan has lots of other interesting features. There are craters that are evidence of past bombardment in the Saturnian system. There are dune fields around the equator, similar to dune fields that we would see in deserts here on the Earth. There's tentative evidence of volcanoes on the surface of Titan, but not volcanoes spewing silicate magma up into the air, but magma that's formed from a form of frozen ice, ice that's fluid and liquid, erupting from what we call a cryovolcano. But one of the most incredible things about Titan is up there in the top left. That image, taken by a radar system on board Cassini, is of a lake on another planet. Never in our exploration have we discovered a real body of water or a body of fluid on the surface of another location. Planetary exploration is often likened to the early sailing ships going out and exploring the world's oceans. But we've never actually had a liquid ocean to sail upon before. For the first time we do. This image is taken by the Cassini orbiter, and that bright spot you see at the North Pole is sunlight reflecting off the surface of that lake, back in the direction of the Cassini spacecraft. Sunlight reflected from an alien lake of liquid methane and liquid ethane. So, of course, we've got ambitious ideas to go and explore that lake. These are not as far-fetched as they might first seem. The idea of landing something in the lake that could float around, could take photographs back at the shoreline and look at the mountain ranges and look at the outflow channels, we know that's possible. We can do that with today's technology. In fact, we know that we would drift by maybe a kilometre or so a day, so we'd be able to sample sediments from different outflow channels. Say you have different dendritic features feeding into the particular lake, you can sample the differences in sediments. There's even an idea for a submersible that would drop out of the bottom of one of these things, scoop up sediments from the very bottom of the lake, and analyse those. You may laugh, but these are really not far-fetched ideas and are possible with today's technology, albeit maybe not with today's funding. That's the problem. So, onwards from Titan. My own field of expertise, and in fact what I did my PhD on, is the atmosphere of Saturn. Now, Saturn's atmosphere looks a lot more bland than somewhere like Jupiter. It lacks those red and white zones and belts that you're familiar with if you look through a telescope at the biggest gas giant. There are still belts and zones, but they're much more subdued. And the reason for that is that, unlike Jupiter, Saturn's atmosphere is filled with a smoggy, photochemically produced haze all the way down to the depths of the cloud tops. Every now and then, you see fluffy white convective clouds, and these are clouds of ammonia ice. But most of what you see in those images is this rather ubiquitous, rather diffuse haze all across the surface of the clouds. We don't see the large, long-lived features that you see on somewhere like Jupiter. Small storms do occur. This is an image from the Cassini spacecraft showing vortices that are changing over the course of a few hours and a few days, but they don't last for over a century, which is like something that we would see in the atmosphere of Jupiter. Now, just some orientation before I go any further. If you look through a telescope with your own eyes, you're seeing light being reflected from the cloud decks that are forming in the Jovian or the Saturnian atmosphere. The uppermost cloud is made of ammonia ice, so this is ammonia gas that has frozen to form crystals, and it's those crystals that you're seeing light being reflected from. Now, if you were to go deeper and deeper, you'd come across multiple different cloud decks on Jupiter and Saturn, made of different chemical species. This is a rather alien concept, because on Earth, we only have a single type of cloud. We have water clouds. Okay? Water clouds can be either in the form of droplets or in the form of ices. But on the giant planets, we have different chemicals forming different cloud decks. And most of what you see is light reflected from that ammonia ice. Now, in the thermal infrared, which is where the SEERS instrument is able to measure, I can measure the temperature and the chemistry and the cloud composition across many, many different altitude ranges. So from the cloud decks and upwards through the troposphere and into the region that we call the stratosphere. Now, the broad orientation is that the troposphere is the region where all the churning, bubbling, convective activity is taking place. All the storms, all the plumes, all the activity that, if you see it in the atmosphere of Jupiter, you tend to get a press release out of it. In the stratosphere, just like on Earth, an aeroplane would fly in the stratosphere precisely to avoid all of the turbulence that you might get from that convective churning activity. So the stratosphere, by its very nature, is stable. It doesn't change dynamically very much over the course of time. So I want you to bear those two things in mind. Stratosphere, stable. Troposphere, bubbling, convective, turbulence and storms. This is an incredible image taken by Cassini just a few weeks ago at the end of November of 2012. You're looking straight down into the North Pole of Saturn just there, where we see a swirling hurricane around about the size of the Earth that we think is present at all times within Saturn's season. And in fact, they may be commonplace on all giant planets in our solar system. If you look very closely, you can see individual convective cloud structures and swirls and filaments and different lanes within this vortex. This is like looking down into the eye of a hurricane, but a hurricane existing on a giant planet. And we're not too sure just yet about how this feature works in a dynamical sense. We do know that if you zoom out a little bit, as we've done on the top left just there, that it's encircled by a perfect hexagonal wave. Why on Earth, why on Saturn, there should be a hexagon at the North Pole, we simply don't understand. We have a few theories. I've seen a wonderful one, that it's the solar system's stop sign to prevent aliens coming any closer. But that hexagon, we know, has been there since the time of Voyager in 1981. It's been there for over 30 years. A perfect wave number 6 feature. I defy any of you to come up with an explanation for this. So that's incredible enough. About 3 weeks ago, I was contacted by a husband and wife team working just outside of Adelaide in Australia, who had, from their back garden, a acquired that incredible image of Saturn in the top right. I think they were using a 14-inch Celestron, so a fairly high-power telescope, and obviously they had very good conditions to be able to do this. But they posted this onto an online astronomy forum, where the other users said, well, hey, this would be fantastic if you were to reproject this so it looks like we're looking directly down on the North Pole. When they did, I don't know if you can make that out, but from the ground, an amateur had observed this hexagon for the first time. Then several other amateurs came out of the woodwork to say, hey, I've observed the hexagon too. We're suddenly in an era where someone from that back garden can almost achieve the same sort of science as we can achieve with a $3.5 billion spacecraft. Don't tell NASA that, right? But this is a fabulous opportunity, because if you use a big spacecraft, or if you use professional telescopes like the ones in Hawaii, you have to bid for time, you maybe get a few hours here and there to execute your science observations, and the next time you do it will be several months later. These guys can go out in their back garden whenever they want when Saturn's in season, and Saturn will be reaching its opposition in April, so expect these images just to get better and better over the next few weeks. So I think this is particularly exciting. Amateurs are able to view this hexagonal wave. Now in 2010, actually, in December of 2010, Saturn's normally bland sort of yellowy appearance was spectacularly perturbed by a plume erupting from depth in the northern hemisphere. Now again, just to orient you, Saturn has seasons just like the Earth. It has an axial tilt of 26 degrees. When Cassini first got to Saturn, the rings were open so that the southern hemisphere was facing towards the sun. It was summertime in the southern hemisphere. Over the course of the mission, the rings have closed. In 2009, they were perfectly edge-on, as seen from Earth, so spring in the north, autumn in the south. And over the course of the last few years, they've been slowly opening up again so that it's now springtime conditions in the northern hemisphere. Just like spring in the UK brings wonderful weather and April showers, springtime on Saturn brings abnormal stormy activity, which are not seen in any other season. This single white plume, again spotted by an amateur observer using his backyard telescope. This guy, Chris Goh, working from the Philippines, he owns a furniture shop. He has many, many children, so every night he tries to escape out into his back garden to look at these wonderful images. He was able to capture it before the Cassini spacecraft could even do it. But the Cassini spacecraft then observed how that storm system evolved over the course of time. In this cartoon, it shows you roughly what's taking place. Deep below those visible cloud decks, you have water condensing and releasing energy and creating a plume that rises up. That white plume punches through all the boring haze layers above it to emerge at an altitude where we can start to see it, where it's reflecting sunlight. Now, Saturn and Jupiter have these powerful zonal winds that zip east and west at many meters per second. Those zonal winds take that material that's been lofted upwards and spread it around the planet. And in fact, it only took around about 3 or 4 months for material to go all the way around Saturn and form a complete new white band around the atmosphere. This white band is slowly dissipating now. It's 2 years on since this storm erupted, but had dramatic side effects in the Saturnian atmosphere that we're still beginning to study. And in fact, this was the paper that Stephen referred to earlier. We were able to get unprecedented high-resolution images into the heart of this storm system. And if you try to think of it this way, you've got a rising plume that's very violent in a normally stable atmosphere. That violence, just like if you were hitting the skin of a drum, sends waves or ripples propagating outwards from the point of impact. Now, those waves in Saturn's atmosphere travel in three dimensions. They come up, the plume rises, and then the waves scatter up into the higher atmosphere. Those waves are transporting energy with them. And they were dumped in two regions that we started to call the beacon. Remember I said that the stratosphere was the stable region, the boring region where you wouldn't expect any turbulence. This came as a huge surprise to us. We've never seen perturbations in Saturn's atmosphere quite this large. From December 2010 through to pretty much the present day, those two fuzzy warm regions that have formed in Saturn's atmosphere moved together. The cartoon in the top right is showing you roughly what happened. By April of 2011, those two fuzzy warm regions had overlapped with each other, merged to form a single gigantic hotspot in Saturn's atmosphere that we call this beacon. We've never, ever seen anything like this in a planetary atmosphere before. This was brand new. The temperatures in the centre of that hotspot were some 80 degrees warmer than the surroundings. Imagine if I took this room right now and heated it up by 80 degrees. You would certainly notice the difference. And that's what was going on. It was only in the stratosphere. We could see no counterpart of this in visible light. So if you look through a telescope at visible wavelengths, you'd see nothing. This only jumped out at us in the thermal infrared. It's still there today, and it's going at a constant rate of 3 degrees west per day. It's moving like a beacon, like a lighthouse, gazing out upon the solar system once every 10 hours or so. We could analyse, using the SEERS instrument, the conditions within the centre of that beacon. And ignore a lot of the words on this slide. This was actually presented at a conference recently. But just focus on the four panels in the centre. You're seeing the three-dimensional temperature structure of this beacon. And it peaks at a particular altitude, rather large, like a large pancake structure with diffuse regions above and a well-defined vortex at the 2 millibar level. The third plot down shows a peripheral jet of winds. These are winds that are rotating around that storm at 200 to 400 metres per second around that storm system. It's rotating in a clockwise direction, and so if you know anything about atmospheric science, we call that an anticyclone. The Great Red Spot, for example, is an anticyclone in the Jupiter system. And of course, you all know that the Great Red Spot is the largest storm system in the solar system, right? Wrong. This was three times larger. We discovered something in the atmosphere of Saturn that dwarfed even the Great Red Spot of Jupiter. It was a quite exciting find. Now, that peripheral jet that's whizzing around keeps the air inside the vortex separate from the air outside of the vortex. So combined with the high temperatures, you get some really interesting chemistry taking place that you don't see anywhere else in the Saturnian atmosphere. And this particular gas, this is a hydrocarbon called acetylene, we found to be enhanced by a factor of, I think, almost two within the centre of that vortex. It's showing you that some really unique chemical conditions were taking place. And this is a work in progress. If I come back to give you another talk in a year's time, I'll be able to tell you a little bit more about what's going on here. But I hope I'm giving you a flavour of just how quickly things are changing in this field. And things can crop up that nobody expected and have side effects that scientists such as myself will be studying for many months, if not years, to come. Now, Cassini has been a wonderful workhorse for this sort of science. And this cartoon shows all of the various flybys, all of the science objectives that Cassini has had from 2004, when we first arrived, through to hopefully what will be the end of the mission in 2017, provided nothing goes wrong. Here we are today in 2013 with various flybys of Titan still scheduled and some of the other icy satellites. For example, right now, Cassini spends most of its time in an equatorial orbit going around the equatorial plane. But over the past 12 months or so, it's ramped up to be in a polar orbit. So it's now looking down directly on the poles, which is why I could show you those images of the swirling hurricane at Saturn's North Pole just a few slides back. Now, towards the end of the mission, things start to get really exciting. We're going to get closer to Saturn than we've ever been before. It's an old spacecraft. We can afford to start taking a few risks with this grand old beast. We're going to fly in between the rings, skimming just a few thousand kilometres above the Saturnian cloud tops. Be prepared for images of Saturn that mankind has never seen before. And then sometime in September of 2017, this grand mission that will have been in operation for 15 years or so will plummet into Saturn's atmosphere to be burnt up, to scatter its remains, if you like, across the Saturnian cloud tops. And that's 2017. So what comes next for people like myself in the outer planets community? Well, our attention is drawn back inwards in the solar system, back to Jupiter. Another amateur, this guy, this time a Brit, Damien Peach, who lives down in Selsey on the south coast. He goes out to Barbados once every few months, because in Barbados apparently the astronomical conditions are better or something like that. But he is able to get such spectacular images that he could put together this movie. This is what Jupiter looks like to the naked eye if you were there observing in December of 2012, just a few weeks ago. And that that movie is a complete rotation that you can find on the internet if you're interested. Now, people like Damien, and with work from professional telescopes both in Hawaii and in Chile, we're able to study how the cloud patterns on Jupiter evolve over the course of time. Just like Saturn, with its newly formed white belt because of the storm from 2010, Jupiter can exhibit massive oscillations in its cloud colour. Just look at 2009, with the two regions denoted NEB for North Equatorial Belt and SEB for South Equatorial Belt. They both have this characteristic browny, reddy sort of colour. When Jupiter returned from behind the Sun in 2010, the South Equatorial Belt had vanished. Where does a belt disappear to? Well, what we believe was taking place was a subtle cooling of the atmosphere that allows more ammonia ice crystals to condense, to become these cloudy, wispy layers sitting over the top of the normal reddy-brown belt. So the belt is still there, it's just hiding beneath this newly formed haze layer. Now, the haze was rather diffuse, rather boring, and you might start thinking that this is reminiscent of Saturn's typical appearance. Saturn typically has a rather boring, diffuse haze covering it all over. And in Saturn's haze, back in 2010, we had that white plume ejecting material higher up to reinvigorate lots of turbulent and dynamic activity. Well, on Jupiter, exactly the same thing happened. Over that static, rather boring haze over the South Equatorial Belt, we had the eruption of a plume dredging material from deep beneath the cloud decks of Jupiter, depositing it at high altitude, and spawning several small storm-like events that propagated then around the planet. In fact, with all of those plumes, and you can see three plumes side by side in the image on the bottom left just there, it reinvigorated the red colour, and by the end of 2010 and early 2011, the red colour of the South Equatorial Belt had returned. The reason I'm telling you all this is because this is a weather phenomena. This is a storm that erupts at a single longitude but spreads over the entire planet. Now, weather systems can do that on rapidly rotating planets without continents, mountain ranges, oceans in the way. So this, in a way, is studying a weather phenomena that would occur in a perfect fluid dynamical system, with obvious implications then for the kind of weather phenomena that we see here on Earth that are then perturbed by getting in the way of a mountain range or a particular jet stream, for example. Now, the source of all that activity, both on Saturn and on Jupiter, we believe to be well below the cloud decks that you can see in visible light. So step in a mission called Juno. Juno launched back in 2011. Here's a screenshot from NASA television that showed the launch taking place. A very sophisticated spacecraft called Juno, built by the Americans, is currently en route. In fact, they're going to get there in 2016 and be operating for a year through to 2017. So at the same time as we're doing our final reconnaissance with Cassini at Saturn, we'll also be using Juno to look at the atmosphere of Jupiter. Juno is carrying with it, as well as these three Lego figures, which I've included because I'm not entirely sure what they're there for, but it's a spectacular public engagement activity to have three Lego figures on board. But it carries a microwave instrument. And using microwaves, we can peel back the cloudy veil of Jupiter to look at what's going on beneath the clouds, to look at the source, potentially, of all that bubbling, churning, convective activity I was telling you about. So I'm hoping that within the next few years, the answers to some of these questions that have been raised may finally come to light. We may finally get answers to some of those questions. And Juno will be a really exciting mission when the time comes. Now, not to be outdone, the European Space Agency announced back in May of last year that we would like to fly, for the first time, our own mission to the Jovian system. Now, unlike Juno, which is focused very much on the planet Jupiter, the JUICE spacecraft, which stands for the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, and I do hope and feel that the JUICE name will be changed at some point to something far more eloquent than JUICE. But its target will be the different satellites that are present in the Jovian system, from volcanic Io, which is experiencing such vast tidal forces due to being very close to Jupiter, that it has a liquid molten interior that spews onto the surface of the planet and deposits things like sulfur dioxide frost around these active volcanoes. Hence, it's rather unusual coloration on the surfaces just there on the left. Europa is one of the few moons in the solar system that we believe has a very thin icy crust, and that crust might be only a few kilometres thick, sitting on top of a liquid ocean. It's one of the places that we believe that if life could potentially develop, the oceans of Europa might be that place. It has all of the various ingredients that you need for very basic life to exist. And one of the goals of JUICE is to go and assess the conditions that are prevalent on that particular moon. Ganymede is the largest moon in our solar system, one of the only moons with its own magnetic field. And again, we believe it has a liquid ocean beneath a slightly thicker icy crust. But this is the main target of this mission, to characterise in great depth the largest icy satellite in our solar system. And finally, Callisto, which is the furthest out of the four Galilean satellites. Callisto has not really changed over the entire history of our solar system. You can see this dark cratered surface bears witness to bombardment history that's been taking place for the last 4 billion years. So Callisto's surface is a remnant, really, of or a witness, if you like, to what's been taking place in our solar system over the vast ages of its existence. So taken together, those four moons are the target of the JUICE mission. And over the last few days, it's been announced the suite of instruments that the European Space Agency intends to fly to the Jovian system when we launch in 10 years' time, in 2022. Now, well, 9 years' time. The clock is ticking, I suppose. I'm pleased to say that Oxford will be involved in this mission as well. So we start out with Cassini, a mission that's currently flying, and in 20 years' time, when JUICE gets to the planet Jupiter, Oxford will hopefully be on that spacecraft participating in some of the exciting science of these icy moons. Now, for the last phases of this talk, I want to go even further out to the atmospheres of Uranus and Neptune, the ice giants of our solar system. Unlike Jupiter and Saturn, where the bulk of the gaseous species are hydrogen and helium, the ice giants have much more methane and ammonia and hydrogen sulfide, what we in the astronomy world called heavy molecules. In fact, it's just molecules that are heavier than hydrogen and helium. But that makes the appearance of these worlds very different compared to Jupiter and Saturn. They still have banded structures, and they still have rapidly changing weather events like convective storms. Uranus is one of the most intriguing destinations in our solar system because at some point in its very distant past, a collision caused Uranus to be entirely knocked over on its side. It rotates with its pole in the plane of the ecliptic, in the equatorial plane of the sun, if you like. That means that its seasons are the most bizarre in our entire solar system. Summertime conditions means that the sun is bearing almost directly down on the pole of the planet. So in, 1986, which is when the Voyager 2 spacecraft flew past Uranus for the first time, we were in southern summertime conditions. In 2007, Uranus had moved around the sun and the rings were entirely edge-on. So you've got summer, you've got autumn in one hemisphere and spring in the other. So that's how we see it if we were to look from the ground at the present time. Now that coincided, that movement around the sun and the changing of the seasons, coincided with a few discrete weather events in the atmosphere of Uranus. When Voyager 2 flew past in 1986, they counted a whopping 10 cloud features in the atmosphere of Uranus. Compared to something like Jupiter and Saturn, people were slightly disappointed, I should say. The reason for that bland nature is because Uranus, a bit like Saturn, is filled with a thick haze of material that prevents us from seeing down to where all the interesting churning convective dynamics is taking place. If you look in infrared wavelengths, you start to peel away some of that haze, and we do see small cloud features, but they're not the most exciting in the world. I mean, they last for a few months, possibly, and they tend to be fairly discreet, but there's nothing like the long-lived storm systems that we see on the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn. So here we are again, rather boring, dull Uranus. However, two scientists, or a team of scientists, I should say, working with the Keck telescope out in Hawaii, were able to use a rather sophisticated image processing technique. They stare at Uranus for many, many hours, but by knowing how the winds are evolving in that planet, they can correct for the movement of features and literally move Uranus back in time and stack all the images on top of one another. By stacking those images together, they revealed Uranus as we had never seen it before. This has only been a few months ago. When I first saw this image, I was absolutely gobsmacked. Suddenly you see all that banded structure of Uranus, and it becomes very similar in a way to things like Jupiter and Saturn. You see small-scale convective events taking place. You see turbulent activity at the poles of Uranus. But the most incredible thing for a meteorologist such as myself is the incredible scalloped wave that you can see around Uranus's equator just there. We've not seen anything like that on any other planet in the solar system. And unfortunately, we have very few images like this to be able to understand the origins of the wave, whether it's there all the time, whether it's ephemeral and just comes and goes. So this is something that is hot off the press. Uranus, as you've never seen it before, and proving that it's not quite as boring a planet as we once thought it would be. And finally, out to Neptune. Most of us think of weather systems as being forced by the power of the sun. So as you get further and further away from the parent star, you'd expect weather to be less dramatic, less exciting. And certainly that appears to be true of somewhere like Uranus. But Neptune has the most powerful winds and the most rapidly changing storm systems of any planet in our solar system. In fact, these images on the bottom were taken by some colleagues of ours using the Keck and Gemini telescopes, which show the cloud features evolving dramatically from year to year, and indeed from month to month, and even hour to hour. The false colour movie that's playing just there in the background was acquired by Voyager 2 as it flew in close to Neptune and then turned around and observed Neptune as it was leaving as well. And you can see a large storm system we called the Great Dark Spot at the time when we discovered it in 1989, by analogy with the Great Red Spot on Jupiter. Except when the Hubble Space Telescope was then trained on the atmosphere of Neptune, just a few years later in 94, it had vanished. Totally disappeared. So we have a really active, powerful atmosphere in Neptune that is powered not by the energy from the sun, but by the energy that's left over from its formation. This is a big ball of gas, and that big ball of gas is slowly contracting. You know that if you squeeze a gas, you heat it up. And it's that heat energy, that potential energy being converted to heat, which is powering these huge convective weather systems in the atmosphere of Neptune. So you have to reverse your thinking a bit. It's not just powered by the sun, it's also powered by the internal heat of this huge gaseous planet. These were the parting shots taken by the Voyager 2 spacecraft when they left in 1986 and 1989. I was just a boy at the time when this was all happening, so I've never really been able to witness a spacecraft flying past these two ice giants. I hope and I pray that by the end of my career, I might be able to get to see something like these views once again. And in fact, British scientists, leading a consortium of scientists from across the European Union and the United States, have a concept called Uranus Pathfinder. It's a relatively low-cost mission that would fly some simple instrument into orbit around Uranus. And we put this proposal to ESA a couple of years ago. Sadly, it didn't get very far. They liked the idea, but they were sceptical about the cost that we suggested that we could do it for. But this would have carried a probe to get down into the atmosphere of Uranus for the first time and actually figure out what the chemistry of the interior is made of. Even if we'd have launched in the early 2020s, it would have taken us 15 years to get to the orbit of Uranus. So 2035 would have been the time of getting there. The fact that we failed in getting that mission accepted means it's being pushed now into the 2040s, possibly even the 2050s, before we have another mission to the ice giant. As I said at the beginning, we're planning for the long game just here, and it's probably not going to be people like me who are going to be analysing the data from such a mission, but my children and possibly even my grandchildren who are going to get to look at the ice giants of our solar system. No talk about the outer solar system would be complete without a newsflash of something you can all watch in the next few years. This is all we know about Pluto. Pluto, of course, I like to think of as a planet still, but it was demoted, but still has its own mission dedicated to it. New Horizons is on its way to Pluto as we speak. And when, in January of 2015, I think is the statistic, we should get images of Pluto far better than you can see in this rather rough, coarse image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, that will allow us to study the building blocks of our solar system. Again, we think that Pluto bears witness to some of the earliest evolutionary stages. And so you'll see, or humankind will see for the first time, what the surface of Pluto looks like. But there's a problem. And this problem we've only just discovered, again using the Hubble Space Telescope. We've always known, or known for a long time, that Pluto had a moon called Charon, or Charon, I've never really understood how to pronounce it. But we now know that Pluto bears is home to a system of moons. And these are the moons that we can see. It's very possible that there are much smaller scale structures in the Pluto system that could get in the way of our spacecraft. Our spacecraft isn't going into orbit around Pluto. It's got a single shot. It's going to fly past, and there'll be a six-month period where we can actually get our science data. We're barreling along so quickly that even a small fragment hitting our spacecraft could cause tremendous problems and mean that the mission is curtains, which is not what we want to see. So the engineers are now scratching their heads, and the flight planners are trying to figure out what to do to make sure that we still get a really successful mission and our first glimpses of Pluto's surface. But watch this space. If you look on the BBC website today, in fact, there's been a popular vote to name some of these moons. P4 and P5 are not names that will stick to these moons. And apparently the top suggested name for one of these moons is Vulcan. I think there might be a few Trekkies out there that might have had a hand in this. That's not official. It has to pass the International Astronomy Union first. But certainly it's an exciting time for Pluto science. Beyond a mission to Uranus and Neptune, what would we like to do next? Well, I would like to think that my children and grandchildren will be able to see aerial vehicles exploring places like Mars, Venus, and Titan. Things that would actually fly across the surface for many, many weeks, able to categorise what the atmosphere is like, what it's made of, and crucially how it changes over time, what the weather systems do to alter what we see. And there was actually a mission called Aviator that was proposed by some American colleagues to fly a very simple plane in Titan's atmosphere. The physics of Titan's atmosphere and the gravity of Titan means it's actually easier to fly a plane in Titan's atmosphere than it is on Earth, bizarrely enough. So that was their rationale for flying a small aerial vehicle. We've even got concepts to go to Saturn's rings and scoop up material and return Saturn's ring material to the planet Earth, or fly balloons within the sulfuric acid clouds of somewhere like Venus. There is no shortage of great ideas. And believe it or not, the technology is mostly in place that all of these sorts of missions are achievable. It's only the funding that we lack. So if anybody's got a few billion in their back pocket tonight, and if you'd care to donate, then please, please do. So to summarise where we've got to, I use the entire electromagnetic spectrum via remote sensing to study weather systems on any planet I can get my hands on, but crucially, the giant planets of our solar system as a template for how perfect fluids work in any atmosphere and ocean within our solar system. You've got a lot to look forward to, such as the dramatic end of the Cassini mission, the arrival of Juno in 2016, the development and launch of JUICE over the next two decades, and the arrival of the New Horizons spacecraft at Pluto to give us images that humankind has never seen before. And it's, when all said and done, the science is great, but there are some huge implications of robotic explorers out there in the solar system. And I think this image from the Cassini spacecraft from 2007, I believe, really encapsulates what it means to be a planetary scientist. In this image, you are sat in the shadow of Saturn, a vantage point that no human being has ever had. The Sun is on the far side of Saturn, and you can see it glinting through the upper atmospheric layers on the bottom left just there. That's sunset on Saturn. That's not the most amazing thing about this image. You can see all of the rings being backlit by the Sun itself. So you can see diffuse, dusty rings from this vantage point that you wouldn't normally be able to see if you were looking at it from Earth. But even that's not the most amazing thing about this image. That tiny dot nestled within Saturn's rings is the most incredible thing that Cassini has been able to teach us about. Luckily, by a sheer stroke of luck, the vantage point of Cassini allowed us to look back a billion kilometres into the solar system, and that is the Earth-Moon system as seen through Saturn's rings. Everything we have ever done, everyone we've ever known, and most of the people who will ever live are on those few pixels seen nestled in Saturn's rings, the rings of a gas giant a billion kilometres away. Planetary science isn't just teaching us about these alien locations. It's teaching us a little bit more about our own planet and hopefully to respect the fragile climate system that we have here, which I think ties in with the atmosphere's theme of this particular museum right now. So with that, I'll leave it there and I'll open it up to any questions that you guys might have.